starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. Living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in there. Watching the crows, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, January 26th, 2015. This is Deanna Spingola. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we are free to discuss controversial topics that are not politically correct and those you might not hear on other programs. My website is spingola.com. There you will find information about my three published books, The Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book 2 and 3. My new book will be coming out soon. It is entitled Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com. All of the more recent audio files of my programs are at that site, including the RBN audio files, the audio files from the American Free Press. My Twitter account is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. And of course, you may hear the audio files of this program at SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com. If you have questions during the program, please feel free to call into the program at 646-787-1915. We will be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@Spingola.com, or from the chat room, which is Spingola.chatango.com. Please remember that I do not access my regular email address during the program. Now, if you looked at my schedule page 2 days ago, it's changed just a bit. A couple of days ago, it says, Deanna talks about how the public was persuaded to accept the myth that there exists widespread mental illness and other issues. Okay, so I've added the following issues: the lack of response to the questions that I asked Mr. Halbig on my RBN program on January 10th, 2015, as opposed to the response to my original interview with Mr. Halbig on March 4th, 2014. I asked several questions of Mr. Halbig. And I also added a link about Ed Sheerini and his actor allegations or accusations. So please do visit my schedule page. And I've included a link to the audio file, which actually a friend of mine who is just great at doing this, did a YouTube video, and I've included that link to the YouTube video from the radio program of January 10th of this year. He is also the individual who did the YouTube file for my program from March 4th, which had a lot of very, very negative comments. And I can understand those negative comments. I really can, because it seemed that I was just beating the heck out of Mr. Halbig. And so I responded by explaining myself in the most recent audio file, which is Mr. Hal Big, your answers, please. So anyway, talking about websites, when I had Mr. Hal Big on my program, I talked about his website, the Children's Safety Institute, which was founded ChildrensSafetyInstitute.com. Now, please understand that there are two kinds of websites. There are private and public websites. Now, 4 days after our interview back in March of 2014, Mr. Hal Big took that site down. I think he took it down either 3 or 4 days later. And I was able to go through Who Is, which is a website where you can that you can use, list the owner, the date of inception, and you know, all the information. The ChildrensSafetyInstitute.com is now for sale, but it is also now privatized. In other words, if you click on information about that particular website, like who owns it, it's going to take you to a company that says, well, this website, you really can't see who owns it or anything about it because it is privatized. Now, when I renewed my website registration the last time, I privatized it because I am a troll target. I certainly don't want to have some car crashing into my front yard or to be any more of a target than I already am. Now, after I had Mr. Hal Big on my program, I made the notes of that program available. But some entity cleansed the various postings that he had made on several websites wherein he asked for donations and discouraged people from reading the official Connecticut State Police reports regarding Sandy Hook. I don't know how he managed to have that done. Now, I do not have a donation button, but have personally paid for my website and have self-published my books. I have received donations from some very kind and generous people who I thank very much for their generosity and their thoughtfulness. I pay about $500 a year to a business that hosts my website. All websites have to have a host, and as long as I can afford to do that, I will continue to fund my own efforts, my own research. It kind of it is irritating to get constant regular emails from people asking for money because, oh, their website's going to go down if they don't get, you know, $200, or they're going to, you know, I don't do that. I don't ask for money. Anyway, let me talk just a bit about crisis actors. Ed Sciarrini, who some say used to work for the government, aggressively promoted the idea of crisis actors. He had a website, still has his website, but you cannot find out anything about the website. It is wellaware1, the numeral 1.com. And if you visit that website, you will discover that they are kind of rearranging it. The new site is almost complete, so wellaware.1 is now available for purchase. And I note that he has a donation button. He says, just a few more days, the new site will be ready. And he says that you can donate using PayPal. And that's all fine and good. He might need to do that, which is fine. That's fine. I don't, you know, if somebody wants to ask for donations, that's up to them. I just personally feel that it's not the right thing for me. All righty. So, wanted to talk about several more things. Anyway, he claimed back, oh, I don't know, three or four years ago, Ed Sciarrini claimed that Gabriella Gifford and the Judge Roll shooting was really a FEMA exercise turned into a real story. It all looked pretty credible when you went through his evidence. That is how he got kind of a lot of attention to his ideas of crisis actors. Some radio hosts have promoted his work. Interestingly, I was one of only two radio hosts that the Dallas Goldbug targeted. That's his other name. He made the claim that Julia Mitchell, and this was back in 2012, that Julia Mitchell and Kerry Cassidy are the very same people, very same person. I invited him on my program to prove his allegations that I am Victoria Jackson, which he said I was Victoria Jackson. I don't look anything like her, don't sound anything like her. Our views are polar opposites of each other. Anyway, he initially accepted my offer, then must have remembered that he had made those claims and made a de facto decline. I had Julia Mitchell on my program on July 10th, 2012, and Kerry Cassidy joined us for 15 minutes. I also invited Ed Sciarrini, the Dallas Goldbug, that he could join the conversation and actually had the producer call him, but he did not answer his phone. As I mentioned, Victoria Jackson and I have views that are polar opposite. Now, on July 5th, I had sent Sciarrini and Victoria Jackson an invitation to be on my program. I did not hear back from Jackson, but Sciarrini bonded the very next day and said, sure. I sent him three available dates, but interesting, I never heard back. I then invited him to call into the program to defend his claims. And he didn't do that. During the program, I had the producer call him, but he did not pick up his phone. Now, Sciarrini made some very ludicrous claims on his website, most of which were so bizarre that no one in their right mind would believe them. However, it did create doubt in the minds of a lot of previously suspicious and susceptible people. These claims created just enough doubt to enable people to believe that crisis actors play all the parts in every major event that occurs. Now, I confronted Ed Sciarrini, and I included the URL, the link to a website, an audio website, a YouTube website, which the title of it is Deanna Spingola Confronts Ed Sciarrini, selected clips, so that you can listen to the rhetoric and the conversation. Now, during my program, on the day that I had Julie and Kerry on the program, a very dear friend who's been a friend for 10 years, an internet friend, some of the best people I know I met via the internet, and her name is Brenda. And she said, Sciarrini's PSYOP disinfo operation could be geared not only at confusing and convincing silly, undiscerning folks that people are impersonating others, but moreover, maybe this particular PSYOP is to try and determine just how gullible and able to be manipulated that people really are, to determine just how far their PSYOP operations really can go. So, and even though it's silly, even though some of the allegations that he made on his website are, well, really obvious, it just might be in the back of people's mind. Oh, yes. Yeah, all those people are really actors. Now, I have been accused of shilling for the government's version of Sandy Hook. I do believe that children died at Sandy Hook. And obviously, those children had parents. However, I also recognize that there were and have been egregious exploitations, malicious manipulations, and corporate collaboration with the state of Connecticut and the federal government. I have written a book about what my conclusions are, which I have not made public, not even to my closest friends. I have not shared the contents of my book even with my closest friends. Therefore, I am astounded that apparently omniscient, overconfident people can make the allegation or accusation that they make that I totally buy into and am shilling for the government when no one but my editor knows exactly what my conclusions are. It is absolutely bizarre, to say the least. Okay, let me share with you the contents of my book. And people are going to say, hey, she's just doing this because I'm trying to sell books. Hey, if you want to buy the book, great. If you don't want to buy the book, great. Writers are the people who learn the most from the research and from the writing of a book, just as teachers learn the most in preparing a class. It has been a very educational experience for me. So just let me share the contents of the book. It has 5 parts. Let me just quickly look in my chat room and see what is going on here. I want to just make sure I cover all the bases, and I just got a message on my Skype. Okay, I just want to be sure I'm all the bases, and see, this is Blog Talk Radio is a one-man operation, or in this case, a one-woman operation. So anyway, see if there's anybody in the chat room here. Okay, so let me just share the titles of my chapters, and they have changed since I did share them with, I have shared them before, and I've shared them with my dear uncle, and because he had some questions, and he's not really my uncle, he is just somebody that I lovingly refer to my uncle because he is terrific, and he's sweet, and he's got so much wisdom, and I appreciate him so much. He's a terrific person. Don't always agree, and sometimes I get mad at him, and we quibble a bit, but he's very wise. Anyway, part 1, vaccines, the primary assault. Okay, here are the chapter titles from part 1. Political protocols and the inoculation of disease. Eliminating healthcare competition. The contaminated polio vaccine. National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. Vaccine assaults against the military. The military vaccine schedule. Thimerosal, the Trojan horse of the psychopharmacological industry, mercury madness, autism and autism spectrum disorders, babies engaging in risky behavior, hepatitis B, Simpson Wood, science by consensus, the Institute of Medicine, damage control. Part 2, and part 2 is the part is entitled The FDA Protecting the Corporations. Okay, the titles of the chapters. Pre-transformation of the FDA. Commercialization of government-funded inventions, FDA Modernization Act of 1997, Drugs for Tots, Pediatric Psychopharmacology, the FDA Corporate Criminality, and the Substandard of Care. Part 3, the Psych Drugs, the Secondary Assault. Now the chapter headings, Diagnoses by Consensus, Prozac, a blockbuster of a killer. Prozac on Trial, 1991. Chemical lobotomies for everyone. Governor George W. Bush, Connecticut's native son. What's good for Texas is good for the country. Planting another Bush at the White House. Mental health screening, conduit for psych drug profits. Breaking the taboo, drugging the military. Pill profiteering, checkbook science, and Madison Avenue medicine. Ask your doctor if suicide is right for you. Kitty cocaine for the rambunctious child. No child left undrugged. At the corner of happy and wealthy. Part 4. Part 4 is entitled Predictable Violence and Its Aftermath. Now the chapter titles. Adam Lanza, a ticking time bomb. Akathisia, scraping on the neurological chalkboard. Lanza's descent into mania. Obama's executive orders, a spy network in the making. Transformation of mental health in Connecticut. Connecticut screening for early onset mental health disorders. Connecticut's psychopharma cover-up. The Stacked Sandy Hook Advisory Commission. Adam Lanza's Elusive Medical Records. Part 5, Operation Damage Control. Damage control, who benefits? Media monopoly, licensed by the government. Introducing skepticism, disseminating doubt. CNN-CIA. Programming at its finest, accusations about actors. Preponderance of propaganda, conspiracy by consensus. Don't look here. Gun regulations, a distraction psyop. Drilling it into our heads. Distracting people with deceptive details, hoaxology 101. Planting evidence in all the right places. Consensus plus marketing equal belief. Theories co-op evidence. Now seriously, people, does that really sound like I'm shilling for the government? I don't think so. Now, recently there's been some concern about the stories, the news stories, that the Newtown City Council voted to tear down the home where Adam Lanza and his mother lived. Now, I know that this is an extreme example, but would anybody like to live in the home of, or the former home of, John Wayne Gacy? Now, of course, the original home no longer exists. As I said, it is an extreme example. The house was destroyed during the search for bodies and was subsequently razed. The property stood abandoned for years, at least 8 years. Even grass refused to grow there. Eventually, somebody bought the lot and built a house. The address has been changed to throw off tourists with a morbid curiosity. Who would want to rent Jeffrey Dahmer's former apartment? Now, there is a website online which talks about the scenes of grisly murders. Would you buy a house that was the scene of a grisly murder? I don't think that I would. Now, I know that people are kind of, they have superstitions, such as I think that in many hotels, that there's not a 13th floor. In fact, one time, one of the other radio hosts, I think it was Dave Gahary, said that Mr. Halbig was thinking about going to Newtown and living there for a little while. And I said, I know where there's a house available. It's a Lanza home. And he just chuckled and chuckled because it's so apparent that nobody in their right mind would want to actually stay in that house, okay? That house will always be associated with the murder of 20 children, even though only one murder, as terrible as it was, occurred there. A son murdered his mother. What an awful act. And when you think about the fact that this person who started as a geeky, weird little kid turned out to be, a mass murderer. Would you really want to even go into that house? I don't think so. I don't have that much of a curiosity to want to go into that house, let alone live in that house. Now, when we are talking about events, it is always very wise to compare events, similar events, so that you can actually get some kind of relativity to it. Now, a week ago, I watched this movie, and it was called Amish Grace. And it talked about the shooting at the Amish school. And this occurred, and I'm going to share some things from Wikipedia. This occurred on October 2nd, 2006. Now, as I go through this, I'm going to make some comparisons. Occurred at the West Nickel Mines School, an Amish one-room schoolhouse in the Old Order Amish community of Nickel Mines, a village in Bart Township in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. My grandfather used to live in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. But anyway, he lived in a place called Paradise. Gunman Charles Carl Roberts IV took hostages and shot 10 girls aged 6 to 13, killing 5. Then he committed suicide in the schoolhouse. And what was so interesting about this, and which the movie brought out, and it was based on what actually happened, this part of it anyway, the emphasis on forgiveness and reconciliation was the response of the Amish community, and it was widely discussed in the national media. And some of the Amish people, I think there were 30 Amish people who actually attended the funeral of the gunman. They reached out to it's very emotional. And how I am. I get very emotional. But these forgiving people reached out to the gunman's widow and his two sons. Because imagine how terrible they felt about what their father and husband did. I mean, just the most despicable thing that you can do is to kill children. But the Amish reached out and they embraced and befriended the widow. In fact, there was a fund set up for her, a fund set up for the families of the victims, because while the Amish don't believe in having any kind of health insurance, and there were victims who were taken to the hospital, so there were huge hospital bills and everything. But anyway, Roberts, the shooter, backed a pickup truck up to the front of the Amish schoolhouse and entered the school at approximately 10:25 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Just let me check and see if there's any callers. And okay, I'm not going to take calls right now. I have one person that I think is just listening in on his phone. So I don't want to take any calls right now. I do want to present this information because I think it's really, really important. And I think it's really important to make comparisons, because if you live in a vacuum and you're just looking at one event without comparing it to other events, you're not getting you're not getting a whole picture. People need to make comparisons and be objective. Okay, objectivity. I'm always preaching objectivity. You don't look at just one side of any issue. Never, never, never. I used to do this. I would write things and say things on my website. And I in the research for my books, I learned that we need to be objective. And in fact, recently I went through several of my articles, and I posted the following. I know I'm backtracking here. I posted the following. I said, when I first started writing articles in 2005, I probably promulgated many popular theories because of my ignorance. I cringe when I read some of my early efforts. I could cleanse my own archives, but it would be like trying to capture feathers in a whirlwind because my articles are on other websites. While many of the issues that appear in my multi-part articles remain true, I have engaged in further, more objective research and no longer support the same conclusions that I arrived at when I began writing on the internet. People perpetuate false information, often unknowingly, because he or she is quoting or relying on other people's information or their faulty research. Each of us needs to engage in independent, objective research and always, always use critical thinking when reading the research, quote unquote, of others. So that is why it's important to make comparisons, to look at other events so that you can compare what was done in other similar events and then compare that to what people, the claims that are people, that people are making about such events as Sandy Hook. So, getting back to the Amish school shooting. The Amish school shooting, as I mentioned, happened in 2006. And it was approximately 10:25 a.m. that Roberts backed his truck, a pickup truck, up to the front of the Amish schoolhouse and entered the school at 10:25, shortly after the children had returned from recess. He asked the teacher, Emma May Zook, and the students if they had seen a missing Clevis pin on the road. Survivors said that Roberts was mumbling his words and was not making direct eye contact. After the occupants of the schoolroom denied seeing a Clevis pin, which I don't know what that is, Roberts walked out to his truck and reappeared in the classroom holding a Springfield XD 9mm handgun. He ordered the boys to help him carry items into the classroom from the back of the pickup. Zook and her mother, who was visiting the schoolhouse, took this opportunity to escape the school and ran toward a nearby farm to get help. Roberts saw them leave and ordered one of the boys to stop them, threatening to shoot everyone if the women got away. Zook and her mother reached the farm, where they asked Amos Smoker to call 911. Roberts and the boys carried lumber, a shotgun, a stun gun, wires, chains, nails, tools, and a small bag. Also brought into the classroom was a length of wooden board with multiple sets of metal eye hooks. The contents of the bag included a change of clothes, toilet paper, candles, and flexible plastic ties. Using the wooden boards, Roberts barricaded the front door. He ordered the girls to line up against the chalkboard and allowed a pregnant woman, three parents with infants, and all remaining boys to exit the building. One girl also escaped, 9-year-old Emma Fisher, whose older sister remained inside. The 9-year-old, who only spoke Pennsylvania German, did not understand Robert's order, and he said, "Stay here, do not move, you will be shot." So she followed her older brother because she didn't understand. She followed her older brother out of the building, leaving 10 hostages. The 911 call made from the farm where Zook and her mother sought help was recorded at 10:36. Okay, so that's 11 minutes after Roberts pulled his truck up to the school. An article entitled "Revisiting the Amish School Massacre" described the situation prior to the arrival of the first state police troopers. State police troopers. We're out in the middle of nowhere, people, in Lancaster County. An Amish adult male from this farm, with his two large dogs, took the bold opportunity to stealthily approach the windowless back wall of the schoolhouse. Hoping for an opportunity to help the little girls, he slowly crept around one side of the wooden structure and positioned himself as an observer next to a side window. The detailed accounting of the police response continues. And I quote, "Observing that the first patrol vehicle to approach the scene was not slowing down to stop, the Amish man quickly withdrew from his hiding place and sprinted toward the roadway to wave down the trooper, who did a fast U-turn and parked. That would be the last successful attempt at an unnoticed move upon the building by anyone," unquote. The first trooper had arrived at approximately 10:42, about 6 or 7 minutes after the 9/11 call. The police, waiting for reinforcements, attempted to communicate with Roberts via the PA system in their patrol cars. They asked Roberts to throw out his weapons and exit the schoolhouse. Roberts refused, again ordering the officers to leave. By 11 a.m., a large crowd, including police officers, emergency medical technicians, and residents of the village had assembled both outside the schoolhouse and at a nearby ambulance staging area. The state police had set up a nearby ambulance staging area. You don't want all these ambulances running up to the school. It isn't done. County and state police dispatchers had briefly established telephone contact with Roberts as he threatened violence against the children. During interviews conducted later, it became apparent. Let me just check my chat room, the chat room, to see if anyone has said anything. Okay. The name of the movie is Amish Grace. Angie Kay said, I definitely couldn't sleep in a house like that. Okay. I could never sleep in any house that anybody was murdered at, because I just couldn't, because I would feel depressed. I would feel vulnerable beyond belief, vulnerable to the evil that caused a murder. And, yeah, I couldn't do it. Could not do it. Okay. Where was it? Okay, so there was a large crowd of people. They established telephone contact with Roberts, and he continued to threaten violence against the children. During interviews conducted later, it became apparent that all the girls knew of their fate. Now, this is one-room schoolhouse, so there were various ages. Some conversed among themselves throughout the ordeal. Shortly before Roberts opened fire, two sisters, Marion and Barbara Fisher, aged 13 and 11, requested that they be shot first, that the others might be spared. Barbara, the younger one, was wounded, while her older sister was killed. A child's loud screaming was heard from within the school. A team of officers was positioned just behind a shed attached to the rear corner of the schoolhouse, and they requested permission over the radio to approach the windows. The permission was denied. At approximately 11:07, Roberts began shooting the victims. State troopers immediately approached. I want you to keep in mind, as I'm going through this, that at Columbine, the city police, that was not handled by state troopers. It was handled by local officials. Did not enter the school for 3 hours. Okay? Keep that in mind, people, as you compare that to Sandy Hook and to the school shooting here in Lancaster County. At approximately 11:07, and this is, he got there at 10:35, so at 11:07, he began shooting the victims. State troopers immediately approached. As the first trooper in line reached the window, the shooting abruptly stopped. Roberts had committed suicide. Now, people who kill children, they're not psychopaths. Psychopaths act in order to benefit from their acts. Cowards always commit suicide. They want to avoid the criminality. They want to avoid something, and a lot of them have also been on drugs that cause suicidality and homicide ideation. And Roberts is said to have been on drugs. They did not find any drugs in his system, because a lot of mass killers, according to an FBI profiler, Marianne O'Toole, says that a lot of people plan these things and then they go off their drugs so that they can have a clear head, so they know exactly what they're doing, so they can perpetrate their crime with a clear head. It took the troopers about 2.5 minutes to break into the school to assist those children who were not killed instantly. At about 10:10 a.m., A message was broadcast on the police radio, and it says, a mass casualty on White Oak Road, Bart Township, with multiple children shot, unquote. And another quote, at 11:11 a.m., police radioed dispatchers again, estimating 10 to 12 patients with head injuries. The first medical helicopter was dispatched. Troopers and local police officers assisted the surviving children, administering first aid. Troopers and local officers continued to tend to the girls, helping the emergency medical technicians provide first aid on the school playground. Ambulances arrived just as the wounded girls were being carried out of the schoolhouse. Helicopters landed shortly thereafter. And those still living, were taken away for medical treatment. Still living, okay? They used helicopters. They used ambulances, okay? You don't take dead people away in helicopters. You just don't, in spite of some claims. The gunman was not Amish. He was a milk truck driver who delivered to several Amish farms in the Nickel Mines area, including some of the victims' families. He had three children and a wife, for whom he left four separate suicide notes. When State Police Commissioner Jeffrey Miller interviewed Robert's co-workers, they claimed to have noticed a change in him over the past couple of months. They also claimed that he seemed to return to normal in the week leading up to the shooting, which implies, to me anyway, that he went off his medication. Miller hypothesizes that this calm may have been when he, Roberts, decided to go through with the shooting. Miller also noted that Roberts' neighbors reported his mood as unusually upbeat and jovial during this time period when I think he was off his meds. On October 10th, 2006, the transcripts of the 9/11 calls made October 2nd, 2006, in connection with the attack were released. The callers identified in the transcripts were Amos Smoker, the same man who telephoned 9/11, reporting the armed invader at the school, Roberts, and Roberts' wife, Marie. In some cases, the transcript indicates the line went dead because the call was transferred to state police and was not recorded by Lancaster County. At 10:35, Amos Smoker placed the call on behalf of the school teacher. So, I mean, it was, that school teacher must have been, she ran like the wind to get to that nearby farm to summon help. About the time of this initial call for help, a pregnant woman, three parents with infants, and all 15 male students were told to leave the school by Roberts. The first officer arrived 6 minutes later. As the first troopers approached the building, Roberts ordered them to leave or else he would start shooting. Roberts continued to demand that the police leave as the troopers attempted to communicate with him via the PA system in their police cars. At 10:41, a second caller reported the incident and was transferred to the state police. At 10:55, Roberts was reaching the final stages of his plan. He had arranged the bound girls in front of the classroom near the chalkboard. He made two cell phone calls, one to his wife and the next to police. He warned the 9/11 dispatcher that if the state police were not off the property in 2 seconds, he would kill the children. The dispatcher attempted to delay him and put him in touch with the state police, but Roberts ended the call. Two of the girls began negotiating with Roberts. They pleaded for him to shoot them first. Those were the two sisters, the Fisher sisters. This allowed the girls a little extra time for possible escape. At approximately 10:07, Roberts followed through with his threats and the sound of rapid gunfire was heard. At 10:58, Mrs. Roberts had called 9/11 after arriving home from a prayer study group meeting. She had discovered the suicide note on the kitchen table and had received a brief and disturbing emotional phone call from her husband. The 9/11 dispatcher put her in touch with the state police. After the police entered the schoolhouse, all of the wounded were taken to the hospitals. Two had died at the schoolhouse. One was pronounced dead on arrival at Lancaster General Hospital, and two sisters survived until the early hours of October 3rd when they were taken off life support. All of the victims survived the immediate attack were brought to Lancaster General Hospital, stabilized, and then transferred to hospitals with pediatric trauma care. Three of the children were admitted to Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, four of them to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and one to Christiana Hospital in Newark, Delaware, reported a state police spokesman. They always select a spokesman because if they don't have one spokesman, then you're going to get all kinds of rhetoric. You need one person that answers the questions at the press conferences, because that is just how it's done. Reports stated that most of the girls were shot execution style in the back of the head. The ages of the girls, of the victims, ranged 6 to 16. According to the Washington Post, police and coroner reports of the children's wounds differed dramatically. Pennsylvania State Police Commissioner Jeffrey Miller said Robert shot his victims in the head at close range with 17 or 18 shots fired in all, including the one he used to take his own life. As police stormed into the building by breaking through the glass, the window glass, Janice Ballinger, deputy coroner in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, counted at least a dozen gunshot pellets, inflicted wounds, and one child alone. So there were so many shots fired. It was more than just 17 or 18. But this deputy coroner, Janice Ballinger, asked a colleague to continue for her. I cannot imagine performing an autopsy on children. And when you recognize that these children were from 6 to 13, I just can't imagine the emotional state that a deputy coroner and a coroner might have been in. Inside the school, Ballinger said there was not one desk, not one chair in the whole schoolroom that was not splattered with either blood or glass. And if you look at all of the pictures, I'm not talking about the few. I'm talking about all of the pictures in the Connecticut State Police report. You're going to see glass. Cars got bullet holes. She said there were bullet holes everywhere. She said there was not one desk, not one chair in the whole schoolroom that was not splattered with either blood or glass. There were bullet holes everywhere, unquote. As a result of their actions in the line of duty, State Police Commissioner Jeffrey B. Miller presented the State Police Medal of Honor to 10 Pennsylvania State Troopers in appreciation for their efforts to assist the victims. Local police officers and emergency personnel were presented commendations by the BART Township Fire Company because they weren't part of the state police troopers. Okay. On the day of the shooting, a grandfather of one of the murdered Amish girls was heard warning some young relatives not to hate the killer. "We must not think evil of this man," he said. Now, the day after the shooting, within 24 hours, Robbie Parker, who some claim was an actor, and somebody, and CNN is the one that filmed that press conference. It was 18, almost 19 minutes, but somebody just decided they're only just going to take 27 seconds of this 18-minute press conference that Robbie Parker gave, during which he showed a lot of emotion. Now, a lot of times, people, in order to get the courage to speak about something that is so emotionally draining, will they do anything they can to get ready to speak about something that is very painful. But during Robbie Parker's 18-minute press conference, he talked about the family of the shooter in much the same way that this Amish farmer, this grandfather of one of the murdered Amish girls, said, and I quote, "We must not think evil of this man," unquote. Because people who do these acts, and somebody on that day posted a message on his website, a website that was created that day, and it said, "No one in their right mind," or I'm just paraphrasing, "nobody in their right mind would kill a bunch of children, so therefore it's a hoax." Well, that's what most people would think. Of course, nobody in their right mind. People on drugs are not in their right mind. People who have been on drugs have experienced a chemical lobotomy. Drugs do strange things to your brain, as I explained in my book. Okay? Another Amish father noted, and I quote, "He had a mother and a wife and a soul, and now he's standing before a just God," unquote. Jack Meyer, a member of the Brethren community living near the Amish in Lancaster County, explained, and I quote, "I don't think there's anybody here that wants to do anything but forgive and not only reach out to those who have suffered a loss in that way, but to reach out to the family of the man who committed these acts," unquote. A Roberts family spokesman said an Amish neighbor comforted the Roberts family hours after the shooting and extended forgiveness to them. I'm sorry, but this is Christianity, people. This is what we do. I believe that people should not seek revenge. Ordinary people seek revenge. I believe in treating others as I would like to be treated. I believe in being fair. I believe in being forgiving. Warfare and mass shooting and killing, that is not the way that we are supposed to think of the people that we share this planet with, or the animals. We are here as stewards of the animals here on this planet. We should not inhumanely slaughter them And heaven forbid that we would slaughter each other. Let me continue. Amish community members visited and comforted Robert's widow, parents, and parents-in-law. This was the beginning of healing for the entire community. Amish man held Robert's sobbing father in his arms, reportedly for as long as an hour, to comfort him. The Amish have also set up a charitable fund for the family of the shooter. And as I mentioned earlier, about 30 members of the Amish community attended Robert's funeral. And Marie Roberts, the widow of the killer, was one of the few outsiders invited to the funeral of one of the victims. Marie Roberts wrote an open letter to her Amish neighbors, thanking them for their forgiveness, grace, and mercy. Now, think of how Peter Lanza must feel. Think of how Ryan Lanza must feel. Peter Lanza said that he wished his son had never been born. I know that he met with two of the families, and I have a feeling that one of those families was the Parker family. So Marie Roberts wrote an open letter to her Amish neighbors, thanking them for their forgiveness, grace, and mercy. You know, the name Lanza is always going to be associated with a mass slaughter. Can you imagine Peter Lanza? He's got to live the rest of his life knowing that his son, his blood, took the life of 20 innocent children? How different could it have been? But anyway, Marie Roberts said, well, it would have been different had psychiatric drugs not entered the picture, which I'm going to talk about in the last hour. But she wrote, and I quote, "Your love for our family has helped to provide the healing we so desperately need. Gifts you've given have touched our hearts in a way no words can describe. Your compassion has reached beyond our family, beyond our community, and is changing our world. And for this, we sincerely thank you," unquote. The Amish do not normally accept charity, but due to the extreme nature of the tragedy, donations were accepted. Richie Lauer, director of the Anabaptist Foundation, said the Amish community, whose religious beliefs prohibit them from having health insurance, will likely use the donations to pay the medical costs of the hospitalized children. Some commentators criticize the quick and complete forgiveness with which the Amish responded, arguing that forgiveness is inappropriate when no remorse has been expressed, and that such an attitude runs the risk of denying the existence of evil, while others were supportive. Donald Craybill and two other scholars of Amish life noted that letting go of grudges is a deeply rooted value in Amish culture, which remembers forgiving martyrs, including Dirk Wilhelms and Jesus himself. They explained that the Amish willingness to forgo vengeance does not undo the tragedy or pardon the wrong, but rather constitutes the first step toward a future that is more hopeful. The New Testament says, pray for your enemies. And I've had enemies. And I pray. And when I pray for those enemies, You don't change your enemy. You do not change your enemy. The Amish did not change the shooter. They changed their attitude about the shooter. They changed themselves. They changed their heart. Because you cannot live peacefully when your heart is full of hatred. It is impossible. When you are seeking vengeance and your heart is filled with hate, it will corrupt the container. That container being yourself. Hatred will act as a corruptive influence upon your own soul. And so that is the wisdom in the praying for others. And the wisdom that the Amish demonstrated. So it was, give you some more information about Roberts. Roberts was at the time a resident of nearby Georgetown, another unincorporated area of Bart Township. He last saw his wife at 8:45 when they walked their children to the bus stop before she left. When Mrs. Roberts returned home a little before 11, she discovered the suicide notes, one addressed to herself and one addressed to each of her children. And then I mentioned that Roberts called his wife from the schoolhouse on his cell phone. So one note Roberts left behind indicated his despondency over a daughter who died approximately 20 minutes after birth, 9 years earlier. He stated that he had been having dreams for the past couple of years about doing something that the state police commissioner said there was no indication that he had done. But anyway, he'd been having nightmares, and he'd been having visions of doing things that he hadn't really done, which is also indicative that he also perhaps was on medication. Miller said there was no evidence that any of the Amish children that Robert shot had been molested. Robert's suicide note spoke of the anger that he held against God because of God taking his daughter. So you see that anger over a 9-year period of time. Who knows what occurred, how he felt about it. But had he been able to get rid of the anger? Well, you can speculate about a lot of things. But the fatalities that day included Naomi Rose Ebersole, age 7, died at the scene. Marion Fisher, age 13, died at the scene. And Marie Stoltzfus, 12, was declared dead on arrival at the Lancaster Hospital. Lena Zuckmiller, age 8, died at the Milton S. Hershey Hospital. Mary Liz Miller, age 7, died at the scene. There were surviving kids, one of which ended up in a wheelchair, impaired for life, with brain damage. After the tragedy, they raised funds of $4.3 million that were donated. And this was the Roberts Family Fund was established also. And the medical care fund that was established for the Amish was $4.3 million. Lifetime Movie Theater, Movie Network, created the film, which I mentioned that I saw a week ago, called Amish Grace, based on the book Amish Grace, How Forgiveness Transcended Tragedy by Donald Craybill, Stephen Nolte, and David L. Weaver-Zerker. That is a comparison that we can make, and we do need to make comparisons because we can see how things happen. He did shoot 10 girls in a matter of just a few minutes. And I was going to. I have an email. Let me just look at the email. It's an email that I received earlier from my dear uncle. He said, conformity and political correctness is practicing what everybody is doing, regardless who is right or wrong. Morality and decency is doing what is right, regardless what everybody else is practicing. I love my uncle. He is so full of wisdom. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. On to the book. Let me just check and see if there's any callers. I think that that my one caller is just listening. Perhaps he could email me and verify. Let me just check in the chat room and see if there are questions or comments. Let me just scroll up. I do believe, as people in the chat, drug-related crime. I honestly do believe it's a drug-related crime. Yes, you gotta love those Amish. Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I used to, in my textile business, I used to call on, I had some Amish customers. Very wonderful people. Wonderful people. Okay. Now to this fabulous book by Christopher Lane. And I'm going to share some details from chapter 4. And he talks about direct-to-consumer marketing, which I also address in my book. And direct-to-consumer marketing happened in 1997, about the same time that there was a transformation at the FDA. And this was at the same time that the FDA said, hey, it's okay, let's use kids as guinea pigs. It's great. Let's go ahead with that. And I talk about that in my book. Okay. And Christopher, I've talked to Christopher, and he said that he would be on the program sometime in March. He's doing a big project, and he's going to be on the program in March. But I do want to share this chapter with you. Not all of it, but a lot of it. Before you sell a drug, you have to sell the disease. And never was this truer than for social anxiety disorder. And the name of his book, oh, please let me, Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness. Yes, normal behavior became a sickness. They have made just about every normal behavior you can think of into a disorder that needs to have a drug. Before you sell a drug, you have to sell the disease. And never was this truer than for social anxiety disorder, which by the 1990s encompassed shyness, fear of urinating in a public lavatory, and concern about saying the wrong thing. The moment the American Psychiatric Association grouped these fears, calling them elements of a troubling, underreported problem, it not only defined a new segment of the population as ill, but also cast their woes in an entirely different form. A signal, therefore, went out to that researchers, mental health professionals, and the drug companies should unearth fresh remedies. These had to fit the American Psychiatric Association, that's APA, the APA's newfound biological emphasis, adopted almost wholesale from 19th century models of pathology. Psychiatry also freed itself to partner with pharmacology and so treat social phobia, mostly with drugs, by dismissing psychoanalysis as costly and ineffective. In other words, forget talking about your problems. Don't talk to your parents about your problems. Here, let us give you a drug. And besides that, if a psychiatrist can see 20 patients in an hour and give them a drug, or see one patient in an hour and make $65, or 20 patients in an hour and make $65 for each of the 20 patients, I don't know, which one would you choose? Let's see. Either all that money or talk to this guy, all that money or talk to this guy for an hour. Let's go with the drugs. Drugs are better. What Robert Spitzer, and I've talked about Robert Spitzer in my book, what Robert Spitzer's task force began in terms of redefining mental disorders, the pharmaceutical company soon completed. For by splitting anxious and phobic reactions into 7 new disorders, the DSM, the DSM. What is DSM? Well, the DSM is the Bible for the psychiatric industry. It is also used by regular family doctors, because some people don't want to go and see their a psychiatrist, but the family doctors can use the DSM and also provide psychiatric drugs. So the use of the DSM at a stroke had greatly expanded the market of potential clients. The task force had also given social phobia a more patient-friendly name and helpfully lowered its diagnostic threshold. The numbers of patients potentially affected skyrocketed. Murray Stein put the upper ceiling at almost 1 in 5. In other words, 1 in 5 patients now, 1 in 5 people, could now be treated for a psychiatric drug. Who knew they were even sick before? But the pharmaceutical giants decided even more needed to be done. As the trade journal PR News announced quite candidly, the British firm Smith Kline Beecham resolved to position social anxiety disorder as, and I quote, a severe medical condition, unquote. Actually, Christopher Lane puts that in quotes. That is what the PR News said. This would be a severe medical condition. Yeah, shyness. The company's internal memos confirm that it was going all out on this front, representing Paxil as the sole means of treating, and I quote again, a highly debilitating, unquote, illness. So shyness was a highly debilitating illness. And I quote again, efforts were concentrated, a confidential report confirmed in 1998, on Smith Kline's having, and I quote, the first SSRI approved for social phobia, social anxiety disorder, an anxiety disorder with enormous potential, unquote. Enormous potential means lots of money, real big money. To reach this goal, the company needed to raise the malady's profile. So it ratcheted up the plight of the socially anxious and stressed the maximum number said to be afflicted. And I quote again, because this is the quotes from the PR news. What these companies do, notes Isaac Marks, is, and I quote, is, gee, here's this undertreated, under-recognized problem, and we really want to show you how common this disorder is in the community. And all these poor people are suffering when they could benefit from our drugs. It's an advertising ploy. And this has been done for other conditions too. And so suddenly they say, and I quote, social anxiety is all the rage. Look what we've been missing, unquote. If anything, and this is a quote from Dr. David Healy, who I've had on the program, who I've quoted extensively in my own book. And he says, and I quote, if anything, Paxil was worse than the other SSRIs, but the company took a very deliberate line that they were going to go after this end of the market, unquote. Barry Brand said in Advertising Age, another magazine, and I quote, every marketer's dream is to find an unidentified or unknown market and develop it. That's what we were able to do with social anxiety disorder, unquote. As product director for Paxil, it's known as Cerax in Britain, the aptly named brand had reason to crow. Although the drug he championed hit the market in 1993, quite late in the game, because Prozac came out in January of 1988. Paxil hit the market, the U.S. market, in 1993, quite late in the game, and thus at a considerable disadvantage to its competitor, Prozac and Zoloft. His aggressive policies soon turned it into one of the few blockbuster drugs, so named because their annual sales exceed $1 billion. Now, keep in mind, in my book, I have in part three, Diagnosis by Consensus, where I'm talking about the DSM, I have a chapter, says Prozac, a blockbuster of a killer. Okay? And there was a hearing in 1991 all about Prozac. But that's another story. All righty. Paxil became a blockbuster drug because its annual sales exceed $1 billion in 2001 alone, with 25 million new prescriptions written for the drug. Paxil sales in the United States increased by a massive 18% from the year before, with yearly revenues exceeding $2 billion nationally. Okay? Just in the United States, $2 billion nationally. The drug had swiftly outpaced its competitors. It became America's best-selling antidepressant, with more than 5,000 Americans beginning a fresh course of the treatment with it every day. Every day, people. Every day, 5,000 Americans, because they were feeling sad or depressed, started treatment every single day. Nor are its sales insignificant in other countries. In Japan, to consider just one example, the sales of Paxil, and I quote, reached 96.5 million. In American dollars in 2001, its first full year on the market and rose sharply in subsequent years. These days, Paxil racks up an annual sales of $2.7 billion worldwide. And while this may sound like a simple success story, it worked because they had the right marketing team. They had a wonderful marketing team. Let me just move forward in Lane's book. And hang on, I just want to. Okay, now Merck is really a. Merck had some earlier tranquilizers like Miltown, which was a muscle relaxant, Nargil, Librium, Valium. In the 1950s, people were just beginning to think that pharmacology might be, it might promise some relief. And then they started talking about the wonder drug. Time magazine talked about aspirin for the soul, and Changing Times talked about, Changing Times advertised aspirin for the soul. Newsweek was talking about happiness pills. Nation in 1956 called something mental laxatives. Time says don't give a damn pills. Today's Health referred to them as peace of mind drugs. And so you had these, Reader's Digest said in 1962, said that that these pills were a Turkish bath in a tablet. And Time in 1980 said it was bottled well-being. So little by little, decade by decade, they were starting to view pills, medicines, chemicals, chemical lobotomy pills as better than talking about your problems. Let me just move forward in his chapter. It's a fabulous book. Fabulous book. Has some pictures in it. There's a one photo here. It's an advertisement. There's a spider web. There's this woman who looks hiding in the middle of the spider web. And it says, for the patient who sees no way out, Milltown. So you had all this advertising that you could only see in magazines. The advertising, the FDA in 1997, about the same time that I talk about the transformation of the FDA, and also at the same time that the FDA gave permission to the clinical trials that it was okay to test things on children, on infants, said, hey, let's talk about this on TV. Let's not hold anything back. Let's market these drugs to anybody that's stupid enough to take them. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say stupid enough to take them. Anybody that is gullible enough to take them, that does not critically think, let's see, do I want to talk about my problems? Do I want to take these drugs? Oh, my doctor must know best. He's been to college. I'm going to go with the doctor and just see what happens, just see how I feel. Okay, let me move ahead, because the doctors fell into this marketing scam also, okay? They felt they were victims also, but still, they go by the standard of care, and as long as a doctor relies on the standard of care, as long as he is covered by the standard of care, which okays all of these drugs, you cannot sue for the doctor for what happens, because he gave you the pill that the DSM said was okay. Because what the DSM did was legitimize drug therapy for medical conditions that would be covered by insurance. And the reason for the DSM was the legitimization of it. Even though they were just making these disorders up. they would sit around a table and say, oh, gosh, what? Well, it was like they were ordering lunch. Do you want Chinese? Do you want, what do you want, Italian today? Oh, what do you think about this disease? This sounds like a pretty, hey, let's call a disease SAD. Let's call SAD. Oh, sounds great. That sounds like a wonderful disease. Okay, so I've had Dr. Alan Castles on the program before, and he and Ray Moynihan wrote a book, which I also have, which I've talked about in my book, that the drug companies now spend, let me just backtrack, in 1997, as Beth Hawkins reports, the agency, talking about the FDA, in 1997 relaxed its rules on pharmaceutical advertising to let the pharmaceutical industry bypass healthcare providers to market its wares direct to consumer, which is DTC, DTC, direct to consumer. And what was the effect? Let's see what the effect of that was. In 1996, the drug companies, and I quote, drug companies spent $595 million on advertising. $595 million in 1996. Within a year, spending rose to $843 million. By 2000, the amount had shot up to nearly $2.5 billion. Today, according to Ray Moynihan and Alan Castles, the total for all drug-related marketing is $25 billion, with $3 billion spent annually on direct-to-consumer advertising alone. That's almost $10 million a day. Now, do you think this is going to affect our attitude towards taking a psychiatric drug? Probably. And they are spending more money on advertising than they are on developing drugs that might actually help you. Now, keep in mind, all drugs have toxic side effects. All drugs. So, Jennifer Daniels, who I've quoted in my book, corroborates that. David Healy warns of the FDA. He said, the regulators depend on advice on experts who increasingly claim independence on the basis that they have consultancies with all the drug companies, unquote. The FDA, bless their little souls, those regulators are in bed with the drug companies. Okay? They're collaborators. They collaborate. All right, let me just run ahead here, speed reading here, so I can talk to you about this wonderful group of people that they got to market these drugs. I'll go through the pictures here. Talks about Eli Lilly's Prozac. Has been around since 1987. Madison Avenue. Okay. Smith Kline brought out Zoloft in 1992. And they touted it as a milder alternative to Prozac. In other words, it didn't make you kill as many. It didn't cause as many suicides, which I talk about in the 1991 hearing. There weren't as many suicides. So Paxil, it was better. It was safer. And Smith Kline did hire an exclusive Madison Avenue public relations firm, Cohn and Wolf, C-O-H-N and Wolf, W-O-L-F-E, a company with expertise in handling pharmaceutical products, Together, they launched an aggressive marketing campaign to create a new market for its product. Just one of the many challenges, and I'm reading from Christopher Lane's book, Chapter 4. Just one of the many challenges facing Cohn and Wolf, as an internal memo explained, was, and I quote, generating excitement about a drug that was introduced 7 years ago, unquote. Another was that Paxil, 1970s, had a spotty record, and at the outset produced troubling side effects, chiefly dependency and withdrawal symptoms within a very short period of time. Further, the earliest clinical trials for paroxetine, which is a chemical name for it, made painfully clear that the drug was actually less effective than older antidepressants, a point the Danish University Antidepressant Group soon confirmed in a large study. SmithKline was so unimpressed by the drug's potential that it considered shelving paroxetine. But they thought, no, let's let Cohn and Wolf see what they can do about it. Maybe they can, you know, help us out a bit to resurrect this ineffective drug that has these horrible side effects and is, well, addictive. But hey, what the heck? And so, in the case of Paxil, these changes were dramatic enough to prompt inquiries on both sides of the Atlantic, including a belated full-scale FDA review in this country, a battle in the courts over whether the drug was habit-forming, a battle in which, unusually, the FDA decided to get involved, thereby compromising the separation of powers. Anyway, it went ahead. The FDA got, you know, they approved it, and all the regulators went ahead with it. And so the company, let me just race ahead here. These companies are not required. Okay, another page. Several well-publicized lawsuits. SmithKline was forced to add a black box warning about the risk of prescribing the drug Paxil, though just a few weeks later, it was caught distributing memos advising its sales representatives not to discuss the suicide-related risk of Paxil with doctors. In other words, the drug detailers, the drug reps, are to go into the doctors, but, you know, don't mention this. It's, you know, that probably won't make everybody commit suicide. So, just don't mention it. What they don't know won't hurt them. Hey, if a few people kill themselves, what the heck? Their family probably will just think it's part of their antidepression or part of their depression. They'll think it's part of the disorder. They won't think to blame it on the drug, because after all, the doctor gave them the drug to help them with the depression, and the doctors know what they're doing. Heck, it was the disease. It was the disease, people. Worse still, there's no doubt, and I'm reading from Christopher's book, no doubt the company knew about these problems right at the start. That is, and I quote, long before Paxil came to the market, unquote. Its first release for Paxil from Cohn and Wolf called the drug, and I quote, safe and well-tolerated, unquote, touting the results of three studies allegedly providing it was, quote, significantly more effective than placebo in treating social anxiety disorder, unquote. Now, social anxiety disorder, it's okay. Some people don't like to use public bathrooms. Okay, so that's okay. Or they don't like to get up in front of an audience of 100 people and speak. Or they're they're just kind of a little bit introverted. That's a characteristic. It's, I'm an introvert. Really, I am. I'm okay alone. I don't like to get up and speak in front of, although I've done it. You should have seen me the first day that I had a radio program. Oh my gosh, I was so nervous back there in October of 2010. I was beside myself. Okay, I didn't take anything though. I thought, hey, that's just one of my characteristics, and I'm okay. I have a right to be nervous. It's okay. Okay, worse still, getting back to Christopher's book, worse still, there's no doubt, I already said that. Okay, its first release said that it was okay. Other key statements, large, meaningless pronouncements, including, and I quote, 69% of the patients treated with Paxil responded to treatment compared to only 29% of the patients given placebo at week 12. Okay, but you don't know who dropped out. Do you know that given all the people, and I cover this in my book, all the people who actually participated in the clinical testing for Prozac amounted to, drum roll here, 286 people. 286 people actually finished a clinical trial of Prozac. Hundreds of people dropped out because they felt so bad. So basically what I'm telling you is this, that the entire body of people in this country or other countries who take Prozac are now participating in a clinical trial. Good luck. Good luck with your life. Hey, but Eli Lilly's making billions, and they can afford to settle out of court. It's just chump change. The billions that they're making, they can afford to pay a billion here, a billion there, a billion to the U.S. government, when the U.S. government finally got around to saying, you know, there might be a tiny, tiny problem with your drug. Let us write you a check. Oh, that takes care of everything. Okay. Go your way. Sin no more. Okay. Although the company invites us to assume that those responses were positive, and I'm reading from Christopher's book, the nature and quality of the responses are not specified. Okay? The company also neglects to mention how many patients participated in the trial and how many dropped out because they had already begun experiencing side effects. Its own archives indicate, however, that dependency and withdrawal issues begin affecting participants just after a few weeks. But you know what? Cohen and Wolf, they don't care. As long as they were making money pushing this drug, they were making a lot of money. Because with the billions that Smith Kline made or would make by selling Paxil, well, hey, Cohn and Wolf made a bundle of money. Bundle of money. Okay, let me just check in the chat room and see if anybody's chatting about... Okay. Introverts are thinkers. Very exceptional people. Thank you. I do a lot of thinking. Less talking, more thinking is sometimes better. Okay, let me just... bipolar is a complete scam. Absolutely. There's no such thing as bipolar. Because you know what? You cannot... Bipolar is talking about chemistry, brain chemistry. You can't measure a person's brain chemistry until they're dead. If you went into a doctor and the doctor looked in the DSM and said, Oh, yes, I see you're bipolar. Yeah, you're bipolar. Let me give you Seroquel. Okay. Yeah, okay, take the Seroquel. That patient should say, "Well, how do you know I'm bipolar? How do you know I've got, this chemical problem with my brain? Can you take a brain chemical tissue a sample so that we can measure it and see before I take the Seroquel?" I have a friend whose girlfriend, and I mentioned this in the book, whose girlfriend had a 16-year-old daughter. And that 16-year-old daughter committed suicide within a week after taking Seroquel. They found her body hanging a few days afterwards. So, anyway, back to the marketing. These drug companies have all the money in the world to market, because these drugs cost a lot of money. The DSM version 3 dramatically expanded the pharmaceutical market for anxiety disorders. SmithKline's executives enthused, and I quote, "The opportunity is enormous. Around 90 million adults in North America and Europe are affected at any one time," unquote. It's all about money. It's all about profits. We're cattle people. We are nothing but a bunch of cattle. That they can say, "Oh yeah, we got a social anxiety disorder, a phobia, you got GAD, you got PTSD. Yeah, you've got this, you've got that, you're anti-depress, you're depressed. Let us give you a pill to take care of that." So that is what they did. So SmithKline went ahead and they used Cohn and Wolf to style the drug mostly as an anxiolytic or remedy for anxiety. I'm forever butchering words, I'm sorry about that. And later still as panacea for acute shyness. If you're shy, if you're a little bit shy, well, Paxil just might, well, it'll do something to you. Although this strategy logically undermined the idea that Paxil was a selective drug, SmithKline was soon targeting it for a spectrum of problems, including generalized anxiety, panic, major depression, obsessive compulsive, and premenstrual dysphoric disorders. Cohn and Wolf were such experts at pitching and recasting healthcare products that few noticed or seemed to mind the startling discrepancy. They said, and I quote, "We're not only tapped into the latest trends," the Cohn-Wolf promotional literature boast, and I quote, "We set them," unquote. With a list of clients including Taco Bell, Hilton Hotels, Visa, and many household brands, the statement is no idle boast. Indeed, by its own admission, the firm's healthcare division, and I'm reading again from Christopher Lane's book, Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness, by hyping a modest result as breakthrough, and I quote, "managing crises," unquote, by bearing equivocal and negative results, it also knows how to influence the FDA and the European Medicines Agency and other regulatory bodies. But Cohn and Wolf say, and I quote, "But it is often the work we do cultivating the marketplace prior to approval that demonstrates the true power of our communication efforts," unquote. Many of the pharmaceutical products, before the FDA ever approves of them, put out marketing so that it puts pressure on the FDA to approve. And that is what happened with Prozac. They already started marketing Prozac. They'd already spent millions of dollars. And so they appealed to the FDA. "Oh, come on, we spent all this money. And look how much we've done for this agency. Couldn't you please, please approve of Prozac?" And that is how it got approved. So let me continue on in Christopher Lane's book. Soon after the FDA gave SmithKline a green light to treat social anxiety, Cohn and Wolf couched the first stages of its campaign as a generous bid to raise public awareness about the disease. The initial goal, as PR News helpfully broadcast, was less to promote Paxil than, and I quote, "to educate reporters, consumers, and, in some cases, physicians in an effort to encourage diagnoses and treatment," unquote. The 1998 memo from SmithKline quoted earlier in the book was even blunter. The company needed to re-educate the public about its notions of mental illness and health as, and I quote, this is from a memo, SmithKline memo, quoted, "Patients with social anxiety disorder often share the common public misperception that what they experience is severe shyness," unquote. In other words, you could be a little shy, but by the time these marketers get done with you, you are going to think you have a severe disorder. Nothing less, and reading from Christopher's book, nothing less than a total transformation in the perception of shyness would do. The title of at least one media article caught the drift. And this media article was titled, and I quote, "You're not shy, you're sick," unquote. As an opening stratagem, then Cohn and Wolf plastered bus shelters across the nation with posters featuring the eye-catching slogan, and I quote, "Imagine being allergic to people," unquote. Accompanying this clever headline was a picture of an attractive yet forlorn-looking man staring morosely into a teacup. And I quote again, "You blush, sweat, shake, even find it hard to breathe," unquote. The man seems to say, and I quote, "That's what social anxiety disorder feels like," unquote. "Oh, I'd better rush off to the doctor. I better rush off to my local doctor. It doesn't matter whether I go to the primary care doctor or a psychiatrist. I'm going to get me some Paxil. I'm going to be great. I'm going to get healthy." Let me check my chat room again. Okay, there's just some comments in here. I'm getting carried away. I know I am getting carried away. I get carried away sometimes. See, I'm not shy. I'm passionate. And I'm passionate about what what I've been studying for the last year. I am passionate about it. I've put my heart into this project. I am really mad at what pharmaceutical company has done to our children from the time they pop out of the womb and until they die. Pharmaceutical industry wants your children because it means big money. And if Cone and Wolf can help get them, they'll do that because it means money. At whom then was the so-called, quote, awareness campaign really aimed? The already afflicted, whom Cone and Wolf hoped would view their distress in a more severe light. Or the healthy but worried, who could be persuaded, like public speaking fears or reluctance to eat alone in public, preceded something far more serious. A crippling, unquote, mental illness, now given an impressive new acronym. Both constituencies were told that while their anxieties had psychological effects, a serotonin deficiency in their brain was most likely responsible. As one 2001 advertisement declared, and I quote, Paxil works to correct the chemical imbalance believed to cause the disorder. Most people who experience side effects on Paxil are not bothered enough to stop taking Paxil. Talk to your doctor about non-habit-forming Paxil today, unquote. That's all a pack of lies. It is habit-forming. Okay, and again, I'm reading from Christopher Lane's book called Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness. It's one of the many books that I purchased. I probably purchased 25 books during my research on my own book. I learned so much. I wish I could have a redo on life sometimes. I would never have given my kids vaccines. I would have homeschooled them. I would have had them at home. Oh, my gosh, the changes that I would have made. So, anyway, thank Cone and Wolf and all you folks out there that are taking Paxil. You bought their marketing. Now, don't you feel fooled? But of course, the people who are listening to this, it's like talking to the already converted, talking to the people who already know about this stuff. All righty, I appreciate you listening to me today, listening to my rant, and I appreciate. My listeners every day, whether you're on RBN or whether you join me here on Blog Talk, I hope that that we can share some information that will help you to make other kinds of choices. And that's what education is all about, is helping us to make other choices that are more humane and more beneficial. Thank you. I so appreciate y'all. Thank you.
It starts with you and me.
It starts with you.
It starts with you and me.